From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. Sponsored by Bio-Rad. Find your perfect match among the full line of Bio-Rad thermocyclers and real-time PCR instruments, plastics, and reagents. On the web at www.bio-rad.com/genomics. This week on the GenCast Network, Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling interviews Dr. John Chaput from the Biodesign Institute at Arizona State University on the directed molecular evolution of non-biological proteins.
Dr. John Chaput is principal investigator at the Biodesign Institute at Arizona State University. He and his team investigate the directed molecular assembly of nanometer-scale protein arrays and the directed molecular evolution of non-biological proteins from large combinatorial libraries. After receiving a BS in chemistry from Creighton University, he won his PhD from the University of California, Riverside. His doctoral thesis research focused on the molecular recognition of natural and non-natural nucleic acids and DNA self-assembly. Dr. Chaput, I understand that you and your scientific team are trying to mimic Darwinian evolution in the laboratory by evolving proteins de novo. What's the goal of this research?
Well, the long-term goal of this research is to make tailor-made protein catalysts in the laboratory that we can use as chemical reagents in certain biotechnology and molecular medicine applications. So these would be proteins that could catalyze a chemical reaction that would normally be considered very difficult, if not perhaps impossible, using standard synthetic methods. While this goal represents one of the major unmet challenges in molecular biology, there have been a number of success stories along the way, and these include the development of catalytic antibodies based on transition state analogs, as well as various computational and selection approaches that attempt to change the function or substrate specificity of an existing protein enzyme. The main difference, however, between our approach and these existing technologies is that we are attempting to generate functional proteins from scratch rather than re-engineering the set of proteins that nature has discovered. By doing this, we are attempting to remove all or most of the biases associated with biology, which allows us the freedom to better understand what types of chemical reactions or protein structures are in fact physically realistic, even if they have not yet been observed in nature.
You describe your work as synthetic evolution. What specifically are you trying to do with this synthetic evolutionary technique, and how does this method improve on what nature has done in terms of creating proteins?
Well, the term synthetic evolution is a term that we came up with to describe our process of evolving proteins in the laboratory. We chose the word synthetic because it more accurately reflects the types of proteins that we are working with. All of the proteins that we select are by definition synthetic, since none of the proteins derive from any sequences found in nature. Instead, all of the sequences in our starting pool derive from an open reading frame that was originally a stochastic sampling of random amino acid sequences. Rather than attempting to select functional catalysts from scratch, we are initially trying to use this technology to address certain fundamental questions related to the origins and evolution of protein function. So these are questions such as, how common is a functional protein in a pool of random sequences, or how difficult is it to evolve a protein to a stably folded state once it has been selected for a particular function? The information we gain by attempting to understand these questions will later be incorporated into future selections aimed at generating proteins with more sophisticated types of functions. So far, all of our initial work has focused on the selection and evolutionary optimization of a family of proteins that we evolved to bind the small molecule target ATP. The original selection, which aimed to determine the probability of finding an ATP-binding protein in a random pool of protein sequences, was actually performed by a former colleague of mine in the Shostak Laboratory by the name of Tony Keefe. When I started to work on this project, Tony had discovered a protein that bound ATP with high affinity and specificity but require that molecule in order to remain stably folded in solution. So as a postdoc in Jack Szostak's lab, I developed the techniques necessary to evolve this protein to a state that was no longer dependent on the presence of ATP in order to remain folded and soluble. At my faculty position here in the Biodesign Institute at Arizona State University, we are now continuing this work by moving this project in a more structure-function direction that involves solving the three-dimensional structures for some of these proteins. We are also investigating the possibility of transforming a ligand-binding protein into a protein that catalyzes substrate-modifying reactions. So first we would select for a protein that binds the substrate and then see if we can further evolve it to a catalytic state. So in terms of your question regarding how this technique might improve upon nature's design, I think that this method has the potential to access functional properties that nature never really required, but are nevertheless important for advancing the fields of biotechnology and molecular medicine. So due to certain evolutionary constraints, in some cases, it might be easier to generate a protein catalyst from scratch than it would be to generate this catalyst from a protein that already exists in biology.
Would you describe the process of how you actually go about evolving a new protein from scratch, as you say, and what types of molecular biological techniques do you rely upon?
To select the ATP binding proteins that I've been talking about, we use a technique called messenger RNA display, which is a cell-free approach to generating proteins that are covalently tagged with their encoding RNA message. We typically start with a library of DNA sequences that encodes an intact open reading frame that is devoid of stop codons and frame shifts. We then transcribe this double-stranded DNA into single-stranded RNA with an enzyme called T7 RNA polymerase. We then modify the 3' end of the transcribed RNA by attaching a DNA linker containing a puromycin residue. And puromycin is really the key to messenger RNA display. You see, puromycin acts as a structural mimic to the 3' acceptor stem of a tyrannosyl tRNA molecule. So when the ribosome translates the RNA message, it stalls at the DNA linker, which allows enough time for puromycin to enter the ribosomal A site and form a covalent bond to the protein in the adjacent P site. This entire reaction occurs using the natural peptidyl transferase activity of the ribosome. Because the DNA is transcribed and translated in vitro, we are able to generate much larger library sizes than is typically observed for most cellular-based approaches. We are talking about trillions of different sequences versus, say, tens to maybe hundreds of millions obtained by most cellular methods. Moreover, we can also remove some of the intrinsic biases associated with the cellular machinery of these organisms to produce libraries that are more reminiscent of our desired random sequence design.
Now, one of the points you make in a paper you and your group published in the journal PLOS ONE in May is that protein stability is a major problem in biology. Why is this the case?
The stability problem that we referred to in the paper arises when you take a biological protein out of its natural environment and try to determine its three-dimensional structure by NMR or X-ray crystallography. The problem is complicated because it not only deals with how proteins are obtained in pure form by heterologous expression, but it also takes into account the intrinsic stability of the protein after expression and purification. While there's been a lot of emphasis placed on this problem, mostly as a result of the major structural initiatives by the National Institutes of Health, which aim to determine the three-dimensional structures for all proteins found in nature, there's a growing feeling among the scientific community that a large portion of these proteins will ultimately need some form of optimization before their three-dimensional structures can be determined. Actually, in one case, it was estimated that perhaps more than half of the genes in a particular bacterial genome would need to be optimized before these proteins could be determined using standard NMR and X-ray crystallography.
Now, in that paper, you went on to note that you wanted to learn more about the evolution of protein folding and stability. How did you go about doing this?
when we began this work, we faced a problem that was empirically very similar to the problems faced by the Protein Structure Initiative, namely that the protein that we were interested in remained folded only in the presence of its selected ligand. But once this ligand was removed from the protein then rapidly precipitated out of solution by forming insoluble aggregates. This situation is similar to the problems we see occurring when biological proteins are taken out of their natural environment. To overcome this limitation, we developed a selection strategy that allows us to evolve our synthetic protein for improved folding stability without compromising its ability to bind ATP. To do this, we changed the selection stringency such that only protein variants that remain stably folded in the presence of increasing concentrations of chemical denaturant, in this case we were using guanidinium hydrochloride, would remain bound to an ATP-derivatized bead, while all other variants that were less well-folded would denature and simply be washed away. We then recovered the bound proteins as input into the next round of selection. So over the course of 5 rounds of selection, we were able to increase the concentration of denaturant from 1.5 molar in round 1 to 3 molar in rounds 4 and 5. And by maintaining this high level of stringency on the selection, we were able to rapidly enrich for stably folded variants that retained their ATP binding function in a relatively short period of time.
Now, an important result of your research is that you discovered that only 2 amino acid changes in a protein sequence enhance the binding, solubility, and heat stability of one of your evolutionary optimized proteins. What are the ramifications of this finding?
After the selection was over, we cloned and sequenced a number of individual proteins to determine what genetic mutations led to the improved folding stability. By comparing all of the sequences obtained, we were able to identify 2 point mutations that were present maybe in perhaps as much as 80 to 90% of the proteins that we sequenced. The 2 mutations were an asparagine to aspartic acid mutation at position 32 and aspartic acid to valine mutation at position 65. Now, looking at the sequences, it would be very difficult to determine the significance of these mutations. So instead, we went ahead and evaluated these mutations by solving the X-ray crystal structures for the evolved double mutant protein as well as the parent sequence. Both structures, it turns out, were highly homologous in the sense that they overlapped with nearly identical structures on top of one another. So using this new structural data, we were able to see that both mutations occupied solvent-exposed positions. And the importance of this finding is that we were able to dramatically improve the folding stability of a synthetic protein by optimizing 2 relatively small surface interactions without disrupting the overall 3-dimensional structure of the protein. And the implication is that similar techniques could be used to improve the stability of many naturally occurring proteins whose 3-dimensional structures are currently precluded by similar folding and solubility problems. A second important finding to come from this study was that the 2 mutations transformed what previously was a mesophilic protein into a thermophilic protein that only begins to unfold at temperatures in excess of 80 degrees Celsius. And this was a really interesting outcome and one that we certainly did not anticipate ahead of time, but it's also an outcome that's interesting to the extent that we're now further investigating this process to understand how proteins evolve to extreme environments, because we certainly didn't select under those sets of conditions. We used actually a very different set of selection conditions than what you might see in the proteins that are found in very extreme environments, such as the geysers at Yellowstone National Park.
Now, finally, what's the next step in your research on the synthetic evolution of proteins?
Well, one of the next big steps that we are currently working on is to see if we can transform our ATP binding protein from a protein that binds a ligand into a protein that catalyzes a reaction with that ligand. And this will really be an interesting area of research since the overall process of selection and optimization is more closely related to how the first protein enzymes may have come into being than, say, other evolutionary techniques such as catalytic antibodies, where transition state analogs are required in order to elicit the development of antibodies with a specified function. In the event that this approach actually proves successful, it would also provide a new paradigm for how we might go about creating tailor-made catalysts in the laboratory.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. Now we'd like your input on some of the points discussed during this week's podcast. Please go to www.genengnews.com/blog and answer the following question. Which specific life science applications do you believe are most promising for proteins that have been evolutionary optimized in the laboratory? Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.